And they're off. I'm D.D. Guttenplan, editor of The Nation magazine. And this is See How They Run, where I'll be talking with Nation columnists, writers, contributors, and special guests to try and give you a sense of what's happening out there and how that might affect the elections in November. Every week here in The Nation, we run lots of terrific, in-depth, sophisticated analysis of news, culture, and politics. Here on See How They Run, we're going to try something a little different. Instead of avoiding the kind of obsessive attention to polls and punditry that are often derided as horse race coverage by political scientists and high-minded commentators, we're going to lean into all of it. Think of it as horse race coverage from the left. We begin with Uncommitted, the movement to protest the Biden administration's unconditional support for Israel's war in Gaza. Partly because of all the constituencies that make up the Democratic Party base, only the supporters of Palestinian rights have organized around the election. And because, given the fact that if he loses Michigan and Wisconsin this time around, that may be the whole ball game, Uncommitted and the Biden campaign are playing a game of political chicken whose stakes couldn't be higher. Waleed Shaheed is the former communications director of Justice Democrats, the group that brought Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and the rest of the squad into electoral politics, and a member of the nation's editorial board. But for the past few months, he's been traveling the country, organizing for Uncommitted. It's my great pleasure to welcome Waleed Shaheed, Nation editorial board member, someone I met in the Bernie Sanders campaign in 2016, and who's lately been very deeply involved in the Uncommitted campaign. So, Waleed, why don't you begin by telling us how you came to be involved with the Uncommitted effort?
So there's two things that happened. One is around Thanksgiving, or during the Thanksgiving holidays, I was home with my family, and my father told me he wasn't going to vote for Biden next year. And my dad's been a lifelong Democrat ever since he's been a citizen. The first time he voted was for Barack Obama. I felt very surprised to hear that from him. And two, I felt like, okay, if my dad, who lives in Northern Virginia, is not voting for Joe Biden, that probably means there's a lot of people like my dad, and especially in the Muslim and Arab community, that aren't going to be voting for President Biden in this year's election. I also just felt kind of like a failure. I mean, Don, we've talked about my father a bit over the years, and, you know,
but for people who haven't followed those conversations, I remember that, you know, that was one of the things that grabbed me when we first met, is you were opening the Sanders office in Philadelphia, and you were talking about your father, who was working as a parking attendant, and kind of his American journey.
Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I think since the financial crisis, my father has gone in and out of, you know, his views toward politics, the political establishment, the Democratic Party. He really didn't like Hillary Clinton in 2016. He voted for Bernie Sanders in the primary and then Hillary in the 2016 general. He voted for Biden in the 2020 general. But he's never voted Republican. He's never left the ballot blank. This time, because of President Biden's support of Netanyahu and Israel's war in Gaza, he feels like he's done with the party. And so, one, I felt a bit like a failure because for the past 10 years, I've been trying to work on making the party more representative of people like my father, more progressive, be a place where Muslims and Arabs could feel like the party was a vehicle for their aspirations. And I also felt like nobody would care if my dad didn't vote. Like, that's a private action that my dad's invisibilizing his anger. Like, he's, by not voting, that's not something you can show. The second thing that happened is that a producer at a cable TV show told me, you know, I've been working as a communications advisor to some of the ceasefire activism, and I had been working as a communications advisor to some of the ceasefire activism in October, November, December by groups like If Not Now and Jewish Voice for Peace and other people who are planning actions around that. By December, reporters were like, we've told this story. The story's boring. Rashida Tlaib did a press conference with rabbis for ceasefire. No reporters attended in D.C. because they thought it was boring. And so this cable TV producer told me, hey, just so you know, we're heading into elections coverage next year. And so there's going to be even less coverage about Gaza on our station going into January because we're reducing our war correspondence coverage, our budget, and we're going to all go into decision 2024. Haley versus Trump, Biden versus Trump. And so the combination of the two experiences of my dad saying he wasn't voting for Biden and this cable TV producer telling me that we're going to have less coverage of Gaza and because of the election made me think we needed to have an intervention in the 2024 Democratic primary in order to take this movement to where the media and political cycle and what to express that there was a fair number of voters in the Democratic Party that were very angry about their own party leaders' conduct on the war. And so I wrote a memo, I sent it around to a lot of organizers, and eventually there were people on the ground willing to make the idea real.
So let me just fill in on why a memo from you might get read by people.
Okay.
You were in the Bernie Sanders campaign in 2016, and then take us from there through, you know, working with these pro-ceasefire groups. I mean, you started a group that was kind of a generational group. You then moved to Justice Democrats. So fill that in to make it a little clearer to people why your memo might actually get some attention.
Yeah, I think most of my career in politics has been at the intersection of social movements, electoral politics, and generational change, and trying to bridge those worlds. And I worked for Bernie in 2016. I was really interested in taking social movement energy in the Obama years into the Democratic Party through electoral politics. I took a circuitous route toward eventually landing at Justice Democrats and becoming one of the first staffers for Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's campaign.
Which at the time was supposed to be a hopeless effort.
Oh, I felt very hopeless by the amount of money she was raising at the Times. And worked on Cynthia Nixon's campaign for governor when she ran against Governor Cuomo and, you know, went back to Justice Democrats afterwards and have been a part of what, you know, people call the squad in Congress and helping elect this progressive block of members of Congress in the Democratic Party. I worked closely with Jamal Bowman and Summer Lee. And, you know, since I'm still on the board of Justice Democrats and, you know, as the nation has reported extensively on, they are locked in a very heated campaign with AIPAC recruited primary opponents right now. I think that elections offer a way because so many voters and so much of the media focuses only on issues as they relate to electoral or political consequences that the Palestine movement or the ceasefire movement or anti-war movement, whatever you want to call it, needed to express itself in the terms of votes, elections that most ordinary people and most journalists understand. And uncommitted, you know, I would have loved to see a candidate run in the Democratic primary in the Eugene McCarthy style way, but we couldn't, there was no one willing to do it.
Well, yeah, let's talk about that for a little bit, because that in a way would have made it easier, but was it just the timing or was it also candidate reluctance? In other words, you know, the timing of the war, opposition to the war, you know, some of us were calling for a ceasefire in October, but it took a while for opposition to the war to spread to the point, you know, where you could say there was a broad movement calling for a ceasefire. And by then, the nominations process was pretty much wrapped up, but was it completely wrapped up or was it just that there were the people you approached were reluctant to stick their neck into the guillotine?
It's a combination of, I mean, these conversations really started happening in late in December. And by that time you would have had a month or two plus the holidays to launch a candidate. So I think part of it was timing. I think also at that time, nobody knew what was going to happen. Many people thought the war might end in a month or two. And so why launch a presidential campaign focused on the war when you don't know if the war will even be around in a couple months? And then, I mean, you know, I was on a panel where the I was grilled by someone at the New York Times who was like, "If why couldn't progressives launch a candidate to, like, regardless of Gaza? Like, there's so much energy in the party on the progressive end. Biden is not that popular amongst young people and progressive Democrats." But honestly, I think it is political suicide to run against President Biden in the Democratic primary. I think a lot of people think of it that way, that you will have ruined your standing in the party for future endeavors to have run against, you know, elderly statesman, Obama's vice president. And so I think
many... an incumbent president who has all the party machinery in his hands.
And it's a losing battle. You will, there's a 90% chance that person would have lost. And so I think nobody wanted to take on, as you put so eloquently, nobody wanted to put their head in the guillotine, except, you know, some no name, like low shot candidates like Marianne Williamson and others who or self-funding candidates like Dean Phillips, who have no real grassroots constituency.
Right. OK, so without a candidate, how did you right. come up with an alternative vehicle for expressing this opposition to, you know, the war Israel is waging in and on Gaza?
Someone told me that in Michigan in 2008, Barack Obama did not make the ballot in Michigan for various reasons. And so his campaign began to tell people to vote uncommitted as in Michigan as in opposition to Hillary Clinton's campaign in Michigan, and uncommitted beat Hillary Clinton. And it was a total embarrassment to the Clinton campaign in 2008. And the headlines were Black voters, liberals, and young voters drive, embarrass Hillary Clinton, Michigan, something like that. And so as we were trying to figure out what we should do on the, how we should relate the anti-war movement to the Democratic Party primaries, I thought this would be a great, you know, at this point in some of the discussions, people were like, people said I should run for president. People were, they were like, you know, we were getting desperate. Like, we just need somebody to run to put their name on the ballot. So actors' names were thrown out, and just activists' names were thrown out. Rashida, we were like, maybe we can just run someone like Rashida Tlaib without her permission, which is illegal, I think. And so, but uncommitted, because uncommitted was already on the ballot in Michigan, it's always on the ballot in a presidential primary, that made everything so much easier because you didn't have to do as much convincing or name recognition that essentially it means none of the above. Or,
and of course, by starting out in Michigan, you start out with the state with the largest and best organized block of Arab American and Muslim American voters probably in the country.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I don't have that much experience in Michigan politics, but I do have experience in other cities and states where there are large like ethnic machines and or ethnic organizing. And so, you know, famously, like in cities like Chicago or New York, there's like there is a Black Democratic Party. In places like in Texas and Arizona, there's like a Latino Democratic Party. In Michigan, there's a very strong organized Arab and Muslim part of the Democratic Party that has engaged in elections, knows how to turn out the vote, has candidates represented at local, state, and federal office. And we were able to plug into an infrastructure that's been building for, you know, 10, 15 years, and many of whom agreed with us in our opposition to U.S. funding for this war. And so an idea is only as good as the organizers who can execute it. And there were really great organizers we were able to work with and get the backing from the mayor of Dearborn, Abdullah Hamoud, Abraham Ayash, who's the Michigan House Majority Floor Leader, Rashida Tlaib. And so, yeah, a lot of the relationships are already there and have been, that community has been organizing, as you said, for over a decade.
So remind us how you did in Michigan, and then what have been the other highlights of the campaign going forward?
So we were all surprised that we were able to win delegates. In order to win delegates in Michigan, you need to have over 15% in a congressional district. And we received over 15% in two congressional districts, Rashida Tlaib's district and Sri Thanedar's district. And that enabled us to win two delegates. We were preparing our talking points to declare a moral victory and symbolic victory because we didn't expect to receive over 15% because, you know, this campaign only cost $200,000. And most statewide campaigns for any electoral effort cost, you know, typically millions of dollars. And so this was an extremely humble effort. We actually ran a calculation that Our $200,000 campaign resulted in $34 million of earned media coverage on CNN and MSNBC. So it was mentioned about 800 to 900 times on CNN and MSNBC. And so we really stretched a dollar wide. Honestly, most of our, something that most people don't know is that the largest turnout in Michigan was actually from precincts where there was a large percentage of voters under 30. So in college towns, like in Ann Arbor, those were the places we did best. It actually, Ann Arbor, we did better than we did in Dearborn. And partly that might be because many voters in Dearborn are honestly done. A lot of them have stopped identifying as Democrats since the war. And a lot of people hung up their phones on us when we were telling them we were calling on behalf of a Democratic primary election. But the same happened in Minnesota, which was the next state. There was the precincts with voters under 30 outperformed even Somali Arab precincts on some of this stuff. And that was really a positive sign for us to show that this wasn't just an Arab and Muslim issue, but also an issue that many young people and young progressives cared about, regardless of their faith or race or background.
And which state did Uncommitted or this campaign get the highest percentage of votes?
Hawaii, which none of us were expecting.
Isn't what you think of when you think of the Arab American diaspora.
Yeah, we got, I think, maybe 29-30% in Hawaii. But yeah, I think to count, there are 27 or 28 delegates altogether who will be at the convention in Chicago. And they're all going through their state party nominating processes now. And, you know, those delegates will receive a lot of media attention in Chicago. We'll have a place to voice their dissent and their perspective on their opposition to Biden's backing of Israel's war. And so I think, and, you know, some of them are Palestinian, some of them are Arab, some are, you know, the native indigenous Hawaiians coming, and it'll be an interesting mix of people.
And so far, how would you characterize Biden's response to this effort?
I think the single biggest thing that shifted with the Uncommitted campaign is the Biden campaign's entire messaging about the war changed. They began to say, instead of attacking progressives and people who are for a ceasefire, their message changed. Well, we agree with the ceasefire too. We're just trying to achieve it. Or Hamas doesn't support a ceasefire and we're trying to achieve it. That was not what they were saying before February. They also, so, you know, in any statement you saw, that was a big thing. You know, I think it also helped create the conditions for more members of Congress to express their opposition to unrestricted weapons aid to Israel. I think it put even Nancy Pelosi signed on to something to show that she wasn't for a full blank check for U.S. weapons to Israel. You know, substantively, I don't think much has changed. The red line for Netanyahu shifts every time he crosses it. We were told that the Rafah invasion would be a red line for Biden. What now? It's about what constitutes a Rafah invasion, but no one is defending Israel's conduct in the war anymore, or Netanyahu's conduct in the war. It's more. You know, it really feels like the message is there is no alternative to the current status quo, and that.
Or that the alternative would be Trump, which would be.
Or the alternative, like, what are you going to do? Vote for Trump, and so. On some level, I'm not surprised, and on another level, the sheer human destruction and the killing of so many children, I thought would maybe wake up even the ICC. Like, I'm honestly surprised by the Biden administration's reaction to the International Criminal Court's arrest warrants or desire to produce warrants for Hamas leaders and for Israeli government officials. To me, it makes. You know, if your entire campaign message, Biden's campaign message, is to restore the soul of democracy and stand up for the Western free and liberal world to oppose the International Criminal Court, even-handed approach to both violence committed by Hamas and Israel against civilians, does not seem like it is undermining your fundamental claim about what your campaign stands for.
Well, no more than, you know, going all out in opposition to Russia's occupation of Ukraine, and then having very little to say about Israel's occupation of the West Bank.
And they supported Biden supported the International Criminal Court's warrants for Putin.
Yes.
So,
but one question is, where does the campaign go from here?
Uncommitted or the Biden campaign?
Your campaign, the uncommitted campaign. You go to Chicago. What are you hoping to achieve in Chicago?
I think we're hoping for two things. One is that the delegates at the convention will be able to show, use the platform of the media to draw attention to the fundamental conflict in the party at the convention, the fundamental divide in the party, which is how we can all stand here and coronate a president who, or a party nominee who has financed what the International Criminal Court is calling war crimes, and to not let that go silently. I think what the White House and the campaign desperately wants is to avoid any conflict, any disruption, any conversation about the war in Gaza.
And do you see an opening in the platform or elsewhere for bringing this to the floor?
So I know that one of your guests is upcoming is Mr. Jim Zogby, who is the platform extraordinaire, and he is working on that. And I don't want to spoil anything he might say or reveal in his interview with you. But that is there are plans to introduce things on the floor and resolutions. There are plans to persuade Biden delegates to join us who might not be uncommitted, but agree with us on the fundamental points that we're making against unrestricted weapons aid. And then secondly, like, we want to mobilize like a large contingent of the Democratic base outside the convention for a nonviolent moral presence so that the delegates on the inside can say it's not just us 27, 28, 30 delegates, but look at how many voices there are on the outside. People of faith, people of no faith, Black, white, and brown, everybody, because the Biden campaign really is doing everything they can to say that this is not an issue for most people. This is not a voting issue. This is a fringe issue for leftist students on campus and maybe some Arabs and Muslims. But the vast majority of the party does not care that much about this issue. And I frankly think that's not true. And I think they've buried their heads in the sand for far too long, and they continue to do so, I think.
So if you take the view that some people do care very deeply about this issue, let's consider it as we wrap things up, two of them. Mm-hmm. You and your dad.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think any of this is going to make any difference to your dad?
That's a good question. I think for a lot of people, especially a lot of Muslims and Arabs, like, there's a lot of, you can't talk about this without the context of the post 9/11 era for Muslims and Arabs. I think like many of us are still living with, in so many ways, our communities were forced to be silent about the U.S. wars on terror in Afghanistan and Iraq out of self-preservation. So in the Muslim and Arab community, I remember my family did this, like, we put American flags on our bumper stickers. We put American flags outside our house to avoid racial harassment, racial profiling, sometimes violence. And I think there are many people who tried their best to assimilate into American politics, American culture, in a way that in which they felt like maybe that would be the best, is just to try to fit in and be quiet.
To blend in.
And I think, you know, one thing about this moment is because it's, two decades after September 11th and the wars on terror, that now because people, Muslim and Arab Americans, are so are assimilated, they don't feel like they need to hide that right. their opposition to this war. And so I think it's a deeply painful question for a lot of people. And for me, I'm trying to be as because of my place in mainstream media and mainstream politics, I'm trying to be descriptive rather than prescriptive of how people in my community feel, because, you know, there aren't that many Muslim progressive or democratic voices in mainstream media or in television or on the left even. And so I think all the polling shows me that if Biden were to end weapons aid or even to restrict weapons aid in a significant way, that a significant number of these uncommitted voters would come back to him. But outside of that, it seems very difficult for him to win back people like my father. And so to me, I'm just trying to show, the uncommitted campaign is trying to show that there is hundreds of thousands, maybe even millions of Democrats who may vote third party or leave the top of the ticket blank or not come to the polls at all in states like Michigan or Georgia or Pennsylvania that aren't being heard right now. But, you know, I don't think have given totally up. They just want to see the president treat people with names and faces like theirs as equally valuable as any Jewish Israeli.
And what about you? Have you made up your mind yet about November?
You know, I have never been a purist or a third party voter. I think what I'm struggling with is, I think I've been really humbled in the last 6 months, is not to move so far ahead of your own community. And so I think my dad has really challenged me on a principled level rather than a strategy level of how you could vote for somebody who doesn't value your life as equal to other people's lives. And to me, that's an ethical, you know, spiritual question rather than a strategic one. And I tend to go through politics with my strategic hat on. And I am not someone who only cares about Palestinian rights. I care about labor rights and climate change and wages and racial justice. And I know that Donald Trump would be horrible on all of those issues, including Palestine, much more worse than President Biden. And so it is likely that I will pull the ballot for President Biden, given those things. But the problem isn't like the problem is not progressive organizers like me. The problem is people like my dad who are thinking with their hearts and feeling with their hearts.
Well, and also who feel, you know, this isn't just a policy dispute. This is a matter of, you know, personal respect and recognition.
Exactly. And I think like most people aren't thinking, I think the lesser of two evils argument here didn't work in 2016 because it's from that argument is from the head and not from the heart. And I think people, on some level, Biden has recognized this by changing some of his messaging to show that he cares about Palestinian and Muslim and Arab suffering, to appeal more to people's heart, to show that he expresses empathy. But until the bombs stop dropping on children, I think, you know, that's what a lot of people are seeing on their phones and on their TV screens. And it is a matter of, yeah, it's a matter of conscience and what you think about your values and the values you want to see represented in politics.
Waleed, it's been a great pleasure, as always, to talk with you. And I look forward to seeing you at the next Nation Editorial Board meeting. And meanwhile, thank you for joining us on See How They Run.
Thanks so much for having me.
Shifting from outside to inside, it's a great pleasure to welcome to See How They Run my friend Jim Zogby, president and founder of the Arab American Institute, but also a longtime member of the Democratic National Committee. Jim, let's get the view from inside the party for a minute about this effort. But before we do that, let's talk about your own bona fides as a Democrat. You were co-manager of Jesse Jackson's campaign in 1988.
Deputy campaign manager, yeah.
An advisor in 1984 and joined the Democratic National Committee in, what, 2001?
No, actually, at the end of the convention in 88, Jackson got a couple of slots on the DNC, and he gave one to me, appointed me. And they came to me, the party leadership came to me and said, Republicans are going to go after Dukakis if you're on the DNC, and so we'd like it if you'd step aside because of the Middle East. And I said, okay. And Ron Brown had come to me, who was going in as chair of the DNC, and he said, I will make it up to you. And it obviously hurt to have to do that, but I did. And then 4 years later, Ron, as he was leaving to go become commerce secretary, appointed me at the end of 92. So I've been on the DNC since then.
Wow.
And now I'm chair of the Ethnic Council, at the DNC. That's the Irish, Italian, Polish, Eastern, Central European, and the Arabs. And I was on the executive committee for 16 years, and I was a chair of the Resolutions Committee for 11. And I was on the Unity Reform Commission, which was the beginning of the end of my being on the executive committee because I pushed for financial accountability and transparency, and they didn't want to deal with that.
So you pushed to an end to dark money, and they decided that between dark money and Zogby, they'll take dark money.
Yes, I couldn't match that.
Well, I have a question for you. In 84, you took one for the team. And in a way, Arab Americans have been taking it for the team since at least 1984.
Yeah. And the 84 campaign was interesting for Jackson because it was the first national campaign that included Arab Americans by name. Up until then, the party had not and would not deal with us. And even for years after that, wouldn't deal with us until Ron Brown came in 1988. First time party chair met with Arab Americans, and the party included Arab American Democrats as part of its coalition. Up until then, there'd been exclusion, deliberate and exclusion, and that changed. The Jackson campaigns changed it. We do have, I think, some degree of recognition now by national Democrats around the country, but I think I'm still the only Arab American. Maybe there's a couple others on the DNC. I was the only Arab American on the executive committee, I think, the entire time. And, you know, when I challenged them on financial accountability, somebody said, "You're challenging the first Latino chair." And I said, "I'm not. This is a structural change. It has nothing to do with Tom Perez at all. I would have done it before him, and I don't want to put my reforms in place until after he leaves. This is for the future of the party." And when they bounced me, I said, the first and only Arab American on the DNC just got bounced, but it didn't matter. It wasn't an issue. I think we do get either excluded or taken for granted. And now all of a sudden, Michigan's in play and they're nervous. They're not willing to change policy, but they are trying to figure out ways to court and develop a relationship. But the relationship's going to be hard to form without a change in policy.
Well, that's, I guess, the question. So tell me about your own involvement with relation to the uncommitted effort this time around.
The uncommitted folks that I know in Michigan, Abbas Alawi and Layla Al-Abed and Waleed Shaheed, who've been kind of advising this whole national effort, are extraordinary people. And they've done great work in elevating this issue in Michigan and around the country. There is voter dissatisfaction. And in all the polling that we're seeing, it's not just the Arab vote, but it's Black, Latino, Asian, young people in general, and progressive Jews. The work that Andy Levin was able to do in Michigan, extraordinary. So it's a movement, I think, that is reflecting the fact that there's dissatisfaction, not just with Joe Biden personally, but with the policy toward the Middle East very specifically. And we're seeing it in polling, but we're also seeing it in the uncommitted vote in states around the country. I think it's 600,000 so far have voted uncommitted in the several states that have had that option available.
And as someone who has long experience inside the party, how much room do you think there really is for movement? And what kind of movement do you think it's realistic to hope for between now and the convention?
Well, there are two things. One would be the party and the campaign, and the other would be policy in the White House. I think there's unfortunately too little movement in the White House on policy. They think that they're doing it just fine. They think that the steps that they're taking to achieve a partial ceasefire and building a pier and trying to get the Saudis on board and making cautious remarks to Netanyahu about, "You really ought not to do this, and maybe you really shouldn't do that," and then turn around and give him $1 billion in new weapons. They think that that's accomplishing something. And I have never dealt with the White House in the 45 years I've been dealing with this stuff in Washington. I've never dealt with the White House as impervious to reality, as refusing to accept what's really happening. We met with people at the White House, State Department rather, just the other day, and I said, "You know genocide's happening. You know what's happening. Why won't you do anything about it?" I don't think that they get it. They don't feel it. Now, transfer to the campaign. They are still operating under the assumption that when the binary choice occurs for voters in November, that it'll fall in place. And I've told them straight out, the binary choice that most voters will experience, the people who are dissatisfied now, will be to either not vote at all and stay home, or to vote for third party. They're not going to switch to vote for you because there is no other choice. Here's the thing. The people that we're talking about, young people, have a very different mindset than somebody in their 40s or 50s or, you know, a woman facing a choice about abortion or, and look at who the people are. It's young Blacks, it's young Latinos, young Asians, young Arabs. They would maybe have the most to lose from a Donald Trump, but frankly, they're so viscerally affected by the insensitivity they see playing out in Gaza that they feel there is no real difference or choice They're willing to wait out 4 years. I keep telling the people in the campaign, you've got to give them a reason to vote. They don't feel that right now. And it takes hard work to get people to vote uncommitted. People who vote uncommitted would normally stay home. To get them to turn out is a big deal. I don't think that we'll necessarily get third-party votes out of this. I think we'll get stay-at-home votes out of this. And if the Obama coalition, which is what they're counting on, falls apart, if they lose 5 to 10% of the Black, Latino, Asian, young, progressive voters, that's it. That's the end of the election for Democrats. They need those votes, and they're not paying attention. And so I think that that's a real problem. The White House doesn't get the need to change policy. The campaign doesn't get the fact that they're being dismissive and disrespectful of the depth of feeling of people by turning a blind eye to the need to change course.
Well, I guess that's the thing that I find, you know, if Biden was 5 points ahead, mm-hmm. then you could see the polls saying, well, this isn't the most salient issue even for young people. When we polled young people, you know, there are polls that say they put it 14th, I think, in mm-hmm. importance 14th. Of issues.
Yeah.
But Biden is behind.
Yeah.
So it's not like you're cruising to a victory and you don't want to change course. It's like you're heading off a cliff.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't they get that?
I think there's a problem with the president and with his senior staff who have been his staff. They're staffers. These are not Zbigniew Brzezinski's and, you know, Anthony Lakes and, you know, national security advisors and secretaries of state of the past. These are folks who've been staffers. All their lives. And so they do what the boss does. And the boss has his ideas locked in place and doesn't appear to be movable. And so they try to find a way to work their way around the edges about this unmovable president. The problem with the consultant class and the campaign operatives is that, number one, they never lose an election because they make their money. You know, the campaign operatives are a multi-billion dollar a year business. In Senate, House, and presidential campaigns, and so there's a culture of the consulting class, and their culture is fixed by doing what they've been doing all along. I mean, if I get another email that says Obama's begging you, I don't know if that works. But one of the issues I raised with the DNC when I was on the Unity Reform Commission was because the bylaws say that they should report on the effectiveness of strategies, do those fundraising emails that I find demeaning and insulting to the president himself, do they actually bring in money? I'd like to see the, you know, how much we spend and how much we take in. No, we can't show you that. Well, I'm not convinced that they work. And in fact, today, being a Democrat only means I'm on a mailing list or I'm on a phone list or I'm on an email list to get asked for money. There's no organic connection between people in the party. And they seem to be just happy with that. That's the way they've been doing it. That's the way that they're happy with it. And they don't really seem, what I tell them, the folks in Michigan are upset or the folks in Pennsylvania are upset. They blow it off because, frankly, it doesn't fit the plan that they have moving forward, which is same old that they did with the Hillary campaign, that they did with the Gore campaign, with the Kerry campaign. Obama was different, but the campaigns that have lost over the last 25 years, it's the same people running. It's the same culture that is producing it. They see white voters as deplorables, and they see Black and Latino voters through a monolithic lens of all Blacks are this and all Latinos are that. 15% to 20% of Black voters are African immigrant today. Totally different mindset. Latino voters are not just Mexican immigrants. They're also Salvadorians and Guatemalans, and they are Venezuelans and Nicaraguans and they're people from the Dominican Republic. They're from all over the place. And it's a very different political culture when you get to know each of these ethnic groups. And the operatives don't get it or don't seem to get it, don't care about it. I don't know how to move them. It might be easier to move the president than it is to move the culture of the campaigns and the party.
But also, isn't this a consequence of the failure to really democratize and open up the party? I mean,
completely.
If you're shutting down debate, that means you don't have to listen to people.
Listen, Democratic Party meetings are like the Bulgarian Communist Party circa 1955. People in the hall will be grumbling about why are we getting rid of New Hampshire? Why are we getting rid of Iowa? People who've never been to Iowa make the decision we're dumping Iowa. But people who've worked in Iowa and know how important those campaigns are to shape candidacies and to give people a chance to winnow through the field and see who actually, when you look them straight in the eye and challenge them at a county fair or at a lunch counter or in a backyard coffee, they know how important it is. They will grumble about it, but then we go into the meeting and nobody wants to vote against the decision. I think there were 17 of us that voted against it. So there is a sense among the party operatives that, and the members, my fellow members of the DNC, not to challenge decisions that get made. And it's just, they go with the flow. And it's quite disturbing. We had a brief window after the Bernie contest in 2016 when Keith Ellison ran. And we had a couple hundred DNC members who were Bernie people. But that has since faded and we're back to the same old, same old. And look, the other part of democracy is that the party chair picks 75 people, names them. They usually come from the White House. They form the majority of the executive committee. They form the majority of all the three standing committees. And so, like, when I tried to create a financial oversight committee on the Unity Reform Commission, I wanted it to be elected. Instead, it got gutted and changed into an appointed financial oversight committee. I said, how can a chair appoint an oversight committee to oversee the decisions that he makes? And nobody wanted to do it.
So while we're on the topic of democracy inside the Democratic Party, Uncommitted has won in fair contests over 24 delegates that are going to the convention.
Yeah.
Is there any chance that that will allow for any discussion of the conduct of the war or American support for the war?
No, and that would be a huge mistake. One of the things that is being pushed for that I think is very important is that the party create a session in the convention to have a respectful debate on this policy.
So that is something you're pushing for?
We're pushing for. It will not be part of the platform. It will not be part of the formal proceedings as currently structured. But I think that they have to create at least the appearance of a discussion, of a debate. Otherwise, people will feel totally shut out. And I think it will be a disaster.
And so you're saying that even now, there's no chance of this coming up as a platform issue?
No, because the platform committee is already picked by the Biden campaign. They've already named all the platform committee members.
And none of them are people who care about this issue.
I think a couple of them do, but I think, you know, when you're picked and appointed by the White House, are you going to buck the White House and challenge the White House? That's not how this town works, right? And so I don't expect them to. I'm hoping at least that, for example, that I might get invited to one of the platform hearings to testify. But beyond testifying, there will not be a debate. Having been through platform debates in the Jackson years and platform debates when I was on the platform drafting committee in the Bernie years, we lose everything all the time. I mean, we couldn't even get the word occupation in the platform in 2016 because the word came down from the Clinton campaign, no. So they voted against it, including progressives that she had appointed to the committee. People will never go against the person that appoints them. And so, you know, it is not going to happen as part of the formal proceedings, unless they will agree to give us at least a 40-minute opportunity to have a debate. And the debate would be between responsible members of Congress, even. Why not have Mark Pocan? Why not have, you know, Pramila, the two chairs of the Progressive Caucus, debate somebody on the other side? It doesn't have to be all hell breaks loose, but it has to be a demonstration that the party is open to a discussion. Do I think it'll happen? No. Should it happen? Absolutely. As a way of sending a message that there is an opportunity for reasoned debate on this issue.
And what are the electoral consequences of it not happening? What are the electoral consequences of the party basically saying, We don't hear you. We don't care.
I think exactly what you expect. The uncommitted will grow into dissent. What I frankly worry about is that there be a replay of Chicago in the streets of Chicago, Chicago 68, and a lot of stay-at-home voters in November, and a lot of people voting for third party. But I don't know. I mean, look, this is an election that is way too important for people to stay home. And I worry. Look, I want Joe Biden to win. I don't want Donald Trump. But for God's sake, the Biden campaign's got to give us something to vote for on an issue that has been so riveting to so many of us. I mean, we are seeing genocide unfolding before our eyes. It is absolutely traumatic, not only in the Middle East, but it's to us here who know Gaza, who know the people, those in particular who have family there, and those who have a global mindset in among young people who are watching genocide play out in real time on their phones. If you don't give them a reason to say you care about that and will change direction, then they're going to stay home. And I don't want to see Trump win, but I can't want Joe Biden to win more than Joe Biden himself wants to win. They got to give us something.
What could they realistically give you?
Well, they could have given us something easy in October when we first approached them at a meeting at the White House. And we said, for God's sake, call for a ceasefire. That was intolerable. They said, can't do that because it would let Hamas stay. I said, do you actually think you're going to get rid of Hamas? I mean, remember when you were getting rid of Saddam? What did you get? You got Iran. Remember when you were getting rid of the PLO? You got Hezbollah. Remember when they were getting rid of Hezbollah in 2006, you got a stronger Hezbollah. I mean, this never quite works out that way, right? And the Taliban are back. I mean, it's like, for God's sake, somebody's got to have a sense of history of how this doesn't work. I don't think that they get it. But what they can do now is at least demand a ceasefire from Israel, suspend weapons and mean it, and actually force Israel out of Gaza and get humanitarian aid in. That's not going to compensate for 35,000 plus people dead. It's not going to compensate for the destruction and devastation of the region, but at least it'll send the message that they care and that they're hearing people. Right now, they're not even indicating that they care or hear people. I mean, imagine, President wanted to get credit for suspending 2,000-pound bombs, and then 2 days later, he sends $1 billion in weapons shipment to Israel. And they told us, well, don't worry about that. They won't be coming to Israel for another year and a half. The optics, I said, doesn't matter when they come. You just took the pressure you were putting on Israel. You just took it off by saying same old, same old. That they don't get that is beyond me.
And yet you're still going to vote for Joe Biden.
Look, Julian Bond taught me a lesson years ago. You don't vote in the election you want. You vote in the election you got. When he, after everything that happened in Chicago, after he himself got dissed as he did, he came out on the final night and put his hands into Humphrey and Muskie and raised them and called for victory. And I told him, I saw him 3 years later when I didn't get to know him until 3 years later. I said, why'd you do that? You devastated us. And he said, at that point, the election was not Julian Bond versus Ed Muskie for vice president. It was Hubert Humphrey versus Richard Nixon. And I had to make a choice. And the only choice I could make was that one, because I could have sat there on my pinnacle above it all and said, I'm not getting into the muck. He said, but a lot of people's lives were at stake and I had to do what I could do. Look, I care about what Donald Trump will do to America. I care about what Donald Trump will do to the world. I care about what he'll do to the most vulnerable here in America, to women, to Black people, to Latinos, to immigrants coming in. I care about all of that. And I, as furious as I am with the insensitivity and the callousness of the way this administration is dealing with Palestine and with issues here at home, frankly, on a really bad day, they're better than Donald Trump on a good day. My worry is that they don't want to win as much as I need them to win, and therefore they're not doing what they need to do to bring that 3, 4, 5% of voters back home. And that hurts. It hurts. It hurts me for the future of the country. And they've dug this hole. And I want them to stop digging. And they don't seem to get the fact that they're in it deeper and deeper every day.
you know, those of us who are most worried about this election and how it might turn out, particularly if people stay home, because I don't really see this issue driving people to vote for Donald Trump. But if people stay home and Trump wins, or if he wins the Electoral College vote because people stayed home in, you know, Michigan and Georgia, do you worry about scapegoating, about, you know, this issue being, this is what cost us the election, the, you know, Arab Americans cost us the election, voters of color cost us the election, this issue cost us the election? Do you worry about that, and how should the left think about that?
I've heard that said, and I have written a piece about that saying, do not visit this defeat on us. This was not us. We asked you to make changes. We asked you, and I say, would you say that to any other group? Would you say that to the Jewish community if you had done something to infuriate them? Would you say it to any other community? And the answer is no, you wouldn't. Do not take us and make us the scapegoat for this defeat. If they lose, it's on them. They let a genocide unfold for 8 months and maybe more. They did nothing to stop it and actually facilitated it by vetoing UN resolutions, now threatening the International Criminal Court and the International Court of Justice. This is not on us. We're begging them to change. They won't. It's on them.
Jim Zogby, as always, a great pleasure to talk to you, and thank you for coming to see how they run.
Thank you.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.